Why are people so different? Why are there such a variety of moral decisions being made? We're using moral in kind of a broad sense, meaning ethical. But Lawrence Kohlberg himself chose the word moral, and sometimes he even says, instead of moral development, moral judgment, meaning deciding, judging different things that come up in a person's life. But there are example after example of a given situation, people acting quite differently. And one, for instance, that I did include in the announcement for supper is the My Lai incident in Vietnam. There was one soldier that was willing to disobey orders to kill all those people. And as it turned out later, some researcher tested him on Kohlberg stages, and sure enough, he was in the higher stages. Principle judgment, he was willing to go beyond obeying the law that authorities had set. So there are times like that when it's good to know these, to understand them. We don't want to use these stages to judge people, because I was saying to Liz, my roommate, that what does that say about somebody's moral development when they're using what they know to judge other people? So please keep that in mind, that this is meant to be an evening for understanding moral development, not to say, aha, I bet my neighbor's only stage two. So don't use it in that way. Instead, it's meant to be helpful. And especially those who work with children. We all started at the beginning and moved on through the various stages. And I hope that we're getting into the more complex ones, the more adequate ones. So we'll go through them and see how, if they're helpful, they're only one little peek into how people make decisions. There are all kinds of other factors. It depends on how you were raised, what your ideology is, what religion you are. Did you grow up in a neighborhood that was dangerous, so you always had to be on guard and use physical force, or at least be aware of physical force? And we'll talk about some of those things later. But there are these differences. Some people, for instance, take the New Testament, Jesus' beautiful words of freedom and helping people get beyond the legalism and make them back into new laws. You know, they take the Sermon on the Mount and think, that means I have to, I ought to, and it's a new legalism. And why do they do that? There's a study, I went to Princeton Seminary, got my master's degree there, and shortly after I left, they did a study that I thought was kind of interesting on moral development. They had these seminarians practice and develop a sermon on the Good Samaritan. And then, as part of the experiment, they had them walk from one building to another and purposely timed it so that, you know, they're almost late, and this was an important assignment, and they get a grade for it and all that. But on the way, the experimenter led them through this little street to the next building, and there was this guy in agony. Looked like he was maybe overdosed on drugs or something. And what they watched to see how many of those seminarians, even if they were almost late, would stop and help this guy. And the results were not too thrilling. There were quite a few that did not stop. And of course, the experimenter reminded them of the time. He didn't say, we've got to keep going, but he reminded them of the time. And the few, well, I don't know if it's few, but at least a smaller percentage that were willing to stop and see what was the matter with this guy, even if they got late, when they tested them, tended to be in the higher stages of moral development. Their thinking and their processing of a situation was such that they were willing to, you know, forget the other rules to take care of human need. I mentioned in the announcement that was read at supper some of the people that are greatly compassionate and very wise, and the two especially that I thought of right offhand were Mother Teresa and then Dom Helder Camara, and maybe some of you saw that film that was about him. How can he be that way? You know, and there's lots of reasons, I suppose. But in terms of the stages of moral development, he would be in the principal judgment. He would be in the higher stages, able to see human need, being beyond just obeying the law. And that's just an introduction, because we'll talk more about that later. Now a little bit about Kohlberg and the stages themselves. By the way, if you do have paper, or if you can't see this board, jot down something, because I'm going to have you think of some examples. And so at least jot down a key word for each stage. Or remember. Good memories in this group.
You moved you to a side. So
sure.
You
when I when I go through them, I will do that. The background on Kohlberg first. Kohlberg is K-O-H-L-B-E-R-G, if you can't see that top. He is a professor that was first at Chicago and then he is now at Harvard. And an interesting fellow. Not too many people make a splash with their PhD. And it took him a long time. I think it took 7 years to write his dissertation. But he decided, first of all, to do something with Sigmund Freud's idea of the superego, which is really the conscience, and see what was going on in terms of the connection between conscience in children and youth and how they behaved. But it kept getting, he discovered he really didn't like Freud that well, and it wasn't fitting together, and he was discovering stuff that didn't fit with what he had been taught. And what happened is that he discovered that the younger children thought one way, and then as they got a little bit bigger, they made different reasons for what they did, and they added new dimensions, and people became more important, and they were able to see how other people thought. And so what came out of his dissertation, which took all those years, are 6 stages of moral development. And he mainly worked with children and youth. They can also be applied to adults. Some adults are still probably primarily in stage 1 and 2, unfortunately, and apply to a lot of different situations. So that's basically the story of Kohlberg's discovery or coming up with these stages. They are primarily cognitive. Now that's a kind of an intellectual term, but that's exactly what it means, how people think. It is not stages of behavior. It's how people think about decisions. So sometimes you can find somebody that will state, principled, lofty terms, and then you really watch them, what they do, and they aren't acting in principled ways. They're not quite as altruistic or whatever as they have said. So sometimes you've got to do the check and balance, like with those guys preaching on the Good Samaritan, that what they say may not be what they do. However, the correlation is pretty high, and we'll get into that too a little bit later. Now let's look at the stages. I'll give some examples as we go so that they'll, I hope, make a little sense. And by the way, keep asking if I either use a word that I haven't defined or if something is not clear. There are kind of some key words that go with each one, so that might help. And I put 2 columns, which you may or may not be able to see. The first one, by the time of stage 5 and 6, they're kind of together. But before that, it's good to look at what an individual would be going through and developing. And then in the second column, societies and nations also make decisions, moral decisions. And so I put some characteristics of those kinds of reasoning. Stage 1, when a child is born, a young child is pretty much making decisions morally in terms of obey mom and dad. The caretaker's rules are non-negotiable. And it's obedience that's the key. That's the child's world. I saw a mother trying to get her, I think about an 18-month-old child to come in for supper. And she was using all these persuasive arguments and that it was time to eat. And she was using like stage 3 and 4 arguments on this little bitty kid. She should have just said, it's supper time. Come on, it's time to eat. So there are times when stage 1, which even if it is sort of authoritarian, is very useful. It is certainly misused. You've probably had teachers that used power and made you obey when you didn't want to and you would have been able to understand more reasons. In the world, in terms of nations, stage 1 thinking is might makes right. Those who have the biggest bombs, the biggest fists, the biggest planes, whatever they're using to fight with, are the ones that are therefore on top. And so it's a physical power.
Should we think of these as cumulative? The person who is in stage 5 also contains 1, 2, 3, and 4, or are they each exclusive if you're only in one stage but not in the other?
They tend to drop off. So that you wouldn't probably use stage 1 by the time you got to stage 4. Although, Kohlberg likes to identify people as being primarily in one stage. So he'll talk about somebody primarily using stage 4 reasoning. My professor, James Rest, and I've got his book along, tends to use percentages. that You might be 10% stage 2 and 30% stage 3 and so forth. And I think that's much more realistic when I watch myself, you know, what reasons I'm using. Sometimes I'm very principled. And then again, I go back to, you know, I want people to like me in stage 3. And so I'm going back and forth, and that it's kind of more of a percentage, and I might even differ from day to day which stage I'm in. One good example of stage 1 using force or power with a child is Anne Sullivan's work with Helen Keller. If you've seen that movie, you know that Helen Keller was just an awful child, throwing food around, and the parents were really, you know, being too good to her. And Anne Sullivan, one of the things she did was make that child behave. There are rules. I am the one who makes the rules, and you are going to learn to be an orderly person. And it helped. So there are times when that physical power is needed, and maybe some might argue, even in the large world among nations. But this is the stage where power, physical power, is the key. Well, that is not too adequate for all moral decisions. And you'll find that these get increasingly adequate and increasingly less hard on us as the human family. So that by the time it's stage 5 and 6, I think you can detect why I'd put Dom Helder, Cameron, some of the people there, that these do gain some comprehensiveness. Stage 2, the child is growing, and there's some negotiation. There's room for rewards. You know, if you do such and such, you can go to the zoo or whatever. So there's rewards and privileges that come with, again, obedience, and the parents are still the authority. But the child is moving on. A lot of stuff that's done in school is stage 2. If you've ever been in a class that uses behavior modification, you know, give M&Ms to the kids if they do such and such, a lot of that is kind of stage 2. It's physical rewards, it's quantifiable, and they can be helped to do good things by being rewarded. In the world out there with nations, nations that use stage 2 are probably making deals and, again, some of this sort of negotiation. But, again, force is still there. And if the deals aren't enforced, the country figures, well, it doesn't matter if I cheat. They don't have enough power to make me do what I said I would do. And one of the books that I was using compared stage 1 and 2. Stage 2 is still an improvement in the world. Because stage 1 would be blast them with bombs and physical torture. And if you move up to stage 2, at least it would be kind of intrigue and cheating and Watergate type things, more the trying to get your way with less force, but still probably in dishonest ways. But stage 1 and 2 go together, and they do have a lot to do with physical power. Then stage 3 and 4 go together. And there people are moving into concern for other people. They're beginning to be social people. And little children, I know quite young children that you could say were using some stage 3 reasoning, because they're already thinking they want to be good. They have friends that they want to be loyal to. They want to be friendly. They're beginning to have some empathy. They can tell how other people feel. And if another little child is hurt, they'll go help. But it's kind of a limited circle. It's just a few friends and family. But they're beginning to move into more adequate ways of looking at the world, and their decisions are becoming more adequate. In the world, it gets to be some groupings of nations or societies, allegiance to like-minded. And they might have some agreements, but they aren't quite as enforceable as stage 4, where it would really get to be treaties and so forth. And then in group, or stage 4, there the social group is important. Society, this is kind of the law and order stage, law and order especially in a good sense, because you could find some of law and order type thinking in earlier stages too. But that is where most of us are in stage 3 and 4. Most of the adult population of the United States is in stage 3 and 4. Basically good people, and they're concerned about their neighbors and their friends. And stage 4, they're concerned for their country. patriotic, and they do obey the laws. They're interested in fairness. And internationally, stage four is much more adequate. It's sort of the United Nations rules, contracts, treaties, again, concerned for social order. So it's getting a little better. And they are learning how to cooperate with each other and not just relying on physical force and sneaking around each other and seeing what they can get by with. Rules matter, fairness matters. And there could be examples all over the place, like Robert's Rules of Order, all the laws we have, lawyers, legal systems, and so forth. Stage five, five and six, which are not as common. In fact, they're quite rare. Yet many of us will read this and they'll say, oh, I must be stage five and six most of the time. And then you start analyzing yourself, and lo and behold, we keep using the others too. And that's okay, because there's good things about all of them. It's just that they're increasingly adequate as you go down. This morning, John made a point, John Schramm, in his Bible study about limited versus wrong. And I think that's a good way to look at these stages. The early ones are more limited. They're not bad or wrong necessarily. You can see that they might be more damaging. But that as you go on, they are less limited, more adequate, more people are taken into consideration, and there's a greater chance for good. Stage five. This is the stage that is typical of the United States Constitution. And that is absolutely remarkable. You know, when you read American history, and especially read all the literature and find out how rare stage five thinking is, and I really do believe that this country was guided by God, that those people did have some guidance in choosing a very wise way of setting up this nation's governance. It is basically stage five thinking. Principles beyond human laws, and so that there's a checks and balances. You know, you wouldn't just allow racist laws to get passed. There'd be a way to check them, get them to be changed. Human rights, we've got the Bill of Rights. Human welfare, human freedom are all important in stage five. And the search for rational solutions, and you start getting into philosophy, which I haven't had a whole lot of, but the moral philosophers and saying what are the higher goods in the world. But assuming that rational people had these problems, what would they do? And so it's a search for rational solutions and just laws. Stage six even goes beyond that and to universal principles. I can't always detect the difference between stage five and six, partly, and neither can a lot of the researchers, because there aren't that many people, you know, to test these out on, that they are not that common. But it's beyond social consensus, because you might have some social consensus with a group that sort of got on the wrong wavelength and decided on something that's not very just and has passed some laws that might need changing. And they place values that are higher than others, might be some of the others from the previous stages, and especially human dignity. And there I do especially think of Domhilder Kammerer and, you know, the poor people. And they, too, have a right for dignity, to have a feeling of worth. So that's just a very brief view of the six stages. Any questions just on the basic rundown? Some of the key words, if you wanted a key word for each one. The first one is obedience or power, kind of depending on which column. Second one is the rewards and privileges. It's some call it hedonism. You're watching out for yourself pretty much at stage two. What can I get out of this? And I'm willing to work with you, but boy, I better get some benefits. It's still pretty self-centered. Stage three and four, moving out into the social world with more concern for other people. Stage three is often called the good boy, good girl stage. I want to be friendly, I want to be liked, and so forth. And stage four is often called law and order, and not necessarily in a negative sense. That society is very important, and therefore you have to have some stability. And then stage five and six are usually grouped together and are called principled judgment or principled thinking. I did a little study on just to try these out. And usually, Kohlberg is not particularly, or has not done too much in religious studies. But I did a little study with junior high, senior high, and adults, choosing some Bible stories and asking people what they thought about these Bible stories and the decisions that the people made. And I won't go into all the details, but I did choose eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. That'd sort of be stage one. Stage two, power. If you do it to me, I can do it to you. That kind of thinking. And stage three and four, I picked the story about Abraham lying about his wife. Should he or shouldn't he have? Now, that's not, you know, moral in a way, and yet he got an advantage by doing it. And then one from Ezra and Nehemiah. Remember the story when they came back from the Exodus, the little group of people, and tried to rebuild the city. And Ezra and Nehemiah decided that they wanted to have a pure state, and therefore the men all had to divorce their non-Jewish wives and kids, send the kids away too. So off went all these non-Jewish wives and kids. And then for stage five and six, of course, I used some of Jesus, both events about Jesus and some of his words, love your enemies, some things that went beyond usual rules. But especially that Ezra and Nehemiah one, I got some interesting responses. You could guess what the adults would say. You know, they thought that must have been culturally determined, and one person even said, well, that's racism. And they had some problems with being that legalistic, sort of stage three, four, rules are so important. But one little boy, a junior high student, said, well, he supposed that maybe to get the nation going again, they needed to do that. And he sure hoped that those guys could find some new wives. And then maybe they could have new kids. And so he was thinking very much stage three, where, you know, kind of simplistic and you can exchange things. Maybe even stage two, where it's pretty much quantity rather than quality. And, you know, if you lose a dog in an accident, you buy a new dog. And so if you lose your wife because she has to go back to her former country, well, you get a new one. So it's very interesting. And just from that tiny little research project to find out that people do think quite differently and that junior high students did not think the same way that senior high and adults did. Now what I would like you to do is, with a partner or two or threes or whatever, a couple people anyway, see if you can think of example of historical figures, especially for stages five and six. But if you want to think of some for other ones too, and then see who we can think of, and we'll pool some of our findings. I mentioned two, but in small groups, see if you can think of other examples from history, not just current times, of people that you think would probably be principled people, willing to look beyond just keeping the law. Okay? Disagree among yourselves. You know, somebody say, oh, I'd never name her, or whatever. Let's see who we found. Some over here. Who might you identify?
Gandhi.
Okay, Gandhi. Anyone else come up with him? Okay, several other places.
Bonhoeffer.
Okay, because he was willing, this, you know, is where the people are willing to go beyond what whatever government they're under is saying that they need to do. Other people? Martin Luther King? Dorothy Day? Gloria Steinem? Schweitzer? Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Other people? Abraham Lincoln, right?
Luther.
Mm-hmm. At least sometimes. You know, you can find some of his arguments that go back to the earlier stages, too.
We also thought Sadat.
Okay.
Sadat.
Right. Gloria Ten Boom, right. Mm-hmm. And Thoreau. Mm-hmm. So. Oh, yeah, Lech Walesa. Mm-hmm. Because these are people that have thought through, you know, this is thinking, and also followed by action, that they have thought through where they are, and sort of we must obey God rather than man, or we must obey, if they're not religious, we must obey principles that we feel are higher than these laws.
Mother Teresa?
Mother Teresa, right. Dan Bergen? Mm-hmm. So that there are these examples. As we say, the world is not terribly full of stage five and six, but some, and I think that one of the purposes that I was willing to present this is to encourage two things as we work with students. I do some teaching. A lot of you are parents and grandparents. You have neighbors and others. two things. In whatever ways to help people keep thinking and moving so that they do move to the higher levels of moral development. And also within each stage, there's a positive element. And if we have time at the end, I'd like us to think of some reasons or some arguments that you could use, even with stage two people, maybe even stage one, for nuclear freeze or no nuclear war. Because what would be some of the arguments that would appeal to people who are thinking that way? Yes, Chuck?
I'm trying to think of nations, examples of nations in 5 and 6, and it's very hard.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's a useful argument.
Okay.
Beyond the fourth level, into the fifth level.
The U.S. and the Marshall Plan,
it
right.
It was sold to the public on the basis that it was in our self-interest in Europe, so there'd be a market for our products. But I think there was some elements in there.
Right, right. And I think often, very high goals have to be coached in terms that many people will accept. Have you ever been to a lecture or maybe even something on ethics and you go out and say, I don't hardly knew what he was talking about, and your friends say, wow, was that great? And maybe the speaker was using stage 5 and 6 reasoning and you were in stage 3 and 4. Or it might be a sermon that the same thing would happen. So in government, often there might be principled thinkers that want this or that to happen. Peace, world unity, more cooperation among nations, but they use more than one stage of reasoning when they present it to the people, which is wise. In fact, Chuck, one thing I noticed, the paper that is going to be for the ALC convention on the nuclear freeze and all, I checked through that, and it appears that there are several kinds of arguments there.
Sure.
You know, it's you appeal to people that the social world matters very much. You appeal to people that say keeping the law is very important, and that might be national security. That kind of fits in there, preserve society. And then also the principled judgment where the greater good is the survival of this beautiful planet than the human race.
This is fascinating. I could go on with examples of international cooperation, but just one that you might want to look into sometime. The law of the sea negotiation.
Okay, the law of the sea.
For subscribing to, or in our case, not subscribing to that treaty.
Mm-hmm.
The United States has pulled back on that.
Right. And there are changes within administrations, as you're pointing out, the law of the seas, and some will go back to other reasoning. You know, stage 3, 4, we've got to watch out for 3, watch out for ourselves. In fact, stage 3 often is a smaller group. You might have a stage 3 person, 2 stage 3 people, and one might be somebody that's putting together a food pantry for the hungry people in the neighborhood and really doing lots of good things, and the other one might be out target practice, joining a racist group. And they're both stage 3. So, and they're both very loyal to a group. It just happened they chose different groups. And so you can find good and bad on both stages, on any stage, except these are pretty much much more likely to be good altruistic types of behavior. One study that's in one of the books that I have is on the 1976 election. And it's kind of small, and it's not a very precise study, but they checked to see who voted for Ford and who voted for Carter, and the people that voted for Ford tended to be stage 3 and 4. Kind of conventional, let's not rock the boat, keep things going, pretty much law and order society and so forth, status quo. And the ones that voted for Carter tended to be stages 2 and 5. and the way the assessor who was putting this together explained it, that two often is sort of college student types. They're just getting themselves together, and they're kind of looking out for somebody that'll look out for the underprivileged. And somehow Carter sort of gave more of that impression to them. And then stage 5, they too felt that maybe Carter would do a little bit more with human rights or whatever. He had a whole lot of stuff with their reasoning, but I thought that was kind of interesting. It's not a terribly airtight study because it was a small sample, but it's still kind of interesting. And again, to do this without judgment, because it's my parents are, you know, status quo people and very good. But at the same time, to kind of watch and see where people move and to enhance the good with each stage.
Great.
here, I think it's kind of good to know something else about how people think. If you're working with junior high students or senior high students, here you are teaching a confirmation class, or I am working with a neighborhood bunch or whatever, you might not be able to get very far if you try to use principled reasoning with youngsters. In fact, college students don't even respond too well to principled reasoning sometimes. Some of them might be beginning to, but one teacher did an experiment with her little class of, I think it was about fifth graders. She's going to have them be a United Nations and the countries of the world. And she was encouraging them to, you know, have human rights, allow each other great freedom, get along, have these laws and so forth so they could get together. She went out to the playground a little bit later after they'd each decided what country they were, and they were fighting like mad. And she was really disappointed and asked the kids to explain why they weren't a nice, peaceful United Nations. And they said, well, we know that nations fight. And so they were acting like the nations that they knew back up almost in stage one and two. They were not able to go beyond where they were. Anyway, over here, Hunt and Perry are two more people who work with cognitive development. And this especially is important for people who are teaching or with parents, and I don't know if you can see them or even if it's worth it. This is just a few words for each one. Hunt talks about conceptual level, and people that are, well, especially children, that are at a very low conceptual level, they're simplistic thinking, and it's kind of right or wrong, black or white. Little kids often are that way. You know, my mom said, and therefore it has to be right. And they just see things in either-or terms. Then they move on to a moderate conceptual level, and they're able to see other points of view. They maybe still want things to be simple, but they are able to see more complex situations. And then finally, high conceptual level is where they're able to see a whole lot of variety of viewpoints and are able to still make some choices within that. The Perry scheme, I think, is good in terms of especially working with students. Concrete dualistic, concrete thinkers. You know, everything has to be black and white and on paper, and none of this abstract stuff of, you know, symbolism and a little bit hard to understand. But that tends to be younger children, again, dualistic, right, wrong, black, white, true or false. Who was it telling about people on a trip to another country and wanting to know, what's the truth? What's the truth? And it's either truth or lies. Well, the world isn't really like that. You know, there's a whole lot of shades in between. But a dualistic person likes things to be black and white, truth or false, and so forth. Communist or free. You know, a whole lot of this pinpointing. Then finally, the children or students move on so that they're concrete multiplistic. They're less comfortable, but they're learning that there are multiple possibilities. Then they are moving in. They move into abstract thinking, and the next one is abstract relativistic, and that's especially college students. And relativism, and they sort of, everything's up for grabs. And I'm finding out that there are other religions, and they don't sound so bad. And how about mine? And you know, they maybe don't know what they believe, and everything is relativistic. The mature state is abstract committed, and I assume most people, adults, have at least approach that so that you know that there's lots of choices, but you have made one, like with religion especially. You have chosen either the one that you were in or found some faith that feels good to you. And other areas too, like politics or whatever, it's committed relativism in a way because you know that there are many choices. But I wanted to bring that up because we might go leaping along here and think that we can move everybody along very quickly, and we can't. They have to also have the intellectual capacity, be able to be an abstract thinker before they can move to these. These are age-related. Children don't get to stage 5 and 6, and even, as I said, high school and college students have some difficulty to move there. Any questions on that connection? Now what I want us to do is to think a little bit about how and why we have moved. I'm assuming that you could sort of detect and maybe even feel some of the places where you feel more comfortable. And this whole village, Holden Village, has talked about the growth as well as the outreach, so that it's both inner as well as outer emphasis. And so what I want you to think of in your own lives, or maybe people around you, you might pick an example of somebody else, how do people grow? How do people change so that they become more compassionate, more able to see what the needs are out there? And it might be external events, it might be internal events. Maybe by internal I mean a practice of prayer, contemplation. Your faith has meant a great deal to you, and it has helped you think things through and come to some allegiances and loyalties that have helped you move. It might also be experiences that have helped you broaden. Some of the psychologists, when they talk about raising children and helping children move through these stages well, encourage parents not to shelter their kids. Let them see the world. Let them have some suffering experiences. Not intentional, but so the dog dies. You don't say that it didn't. And you help them with that grief. And so they have an accident, and so grandma dies, and whatever. That they have their share of hard knocks, because those experiences keep making their world a little bigger. And especially they find that people who have traveled have found out how other people live. I think of that, what was it called, the urban program in Chicago? Those of you who have, anyway, pastors that would go to Chicago and, Urban Training Center. And I would think things like that would change people's perspective and make their world bigger. Find out how other people live. Meet a family from a very poor area. Be in the Peace Corps. Experiences like that. Children especially that are helped with role-taking, how do other people see this? And teachers and parents that say, well, how do you suppose Johnny felt when you, whatever, or how do you suppose so-and-so felt? And so that they're more and more able to see how other people feel. Stage one and two don't really care. That role-taking is just about non-existent. It's power, and it's what I can get by with and what will bring me pleasure. Stage three and four is where this empathy and role-taking comes in, and stage five and six, it's almost, dominant. You're very aware of how other people feel and concern for other people. So do think, what in your life has helped you? And these could be experienced both inner and outer, as I say, and they could be spiritual, they could be maybe psychotherapy, maybe getting married, who knows? But just, again, in small groups, buzz, and let's see if we can find some common threads of what helped people move. And then this might give us some clues as the people that we work with. What can we do in our circles? So what has helped you grow of your findings or remembrances? How about somebody over here? Let's just name some experiences that, or whatever, the kinds of things that you've identified that were at least somewhat in your picture of growth. Okay, 15 years of teaching in an all-black school. That would be a picture, her world would have gotten considerably bigger. Mm-hmm. You would have seen, right, you learned from her. Okay. So she was experiencing prejudice. Reverse prejudice. So many times it'll be those jarring experiences. And seeing that film, Last Grave at Dimbaza, what would it take for some of those white people? What if I had been born there, and was a privileged white person? What kind of experiences would I have to jar me enough to realize that something more needed to be done. And in that case, it was reverse prejudice that jarred her. Other experiences.
And he told us about the necessity of breaking the law for justice. And I never heard of that before from a pastor. That was very impressive. All of us, I think, turned us around. That's
right.
Where we first got into that movement.
So
through a long list of the school we were attending.
Right. And somebody that knew what was going on with that. One of the books that I used as text at the University of Minnesota talks about Martin Luther King and gives even a quote of one of his speeches where he is saying that St. Augustine said that unjust laws are not laws. They do not need to be obeyed. And of course, think of all the problems, or at least to a lot of people, kind of the law and order stage 3-4 people. Laws are laws. You've got to obey them. And civil disobedience was just unthinkable to them. And I also thought of, who was it? Situation Ethics. Who is the guy?
Fletcher.
You know, that some of that, too, would be, at least some of it, might be stage 5-6, where there are things beyond laws. Yes?
My shocking experience was shortly after the World War II, when I finished college and I went to work for a railroad. And I learned that most of the red caps,
no.
College graduates.
Red caps that were college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so each one, I got to know them a little bit and discovered that this was the end of the line for them,
right,
because they were black. And that was a shattering kind of a blow.
It's often exposure, not necessarily that people would stay home all the time. Like I know, she's kind of my foster grandmother, who is, I think, about stage 5, and she hasn't had all these jarring experiences. But for many other people that don't seem to have this natural kindness, it does take some confrontation, some knowledge of what's going on in the world.
Well, one really unforgettable experience that I had was at the University of Minnesota when I saw the movie on the Milgram experiment.
Oh, yes.
Deals with breaking the law and whether, when one does that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'll ever forget that.
That Milgram experiment is, it was contrived, but these people thought that they were shocking somebody in the next room, and of course the stooge, I guess I'll call him, in the other room did screaming and whatever, so that it really, the person that was punching the buttons thought he was shocking the person in the other room. And I think one that even sounded like he died. I mean, at first a lot of screams, and then finally he told him to push another button that was even stronger, and the person just made a moan and then was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And Kohlberg and some others have done follow-up on that Milgram experiment, the electric shocks to people. And the people that kept shocking them, I think it was about 75%, were stage 3-4. And that's sort of the Nazi Germany. You know, I was just following orders.
Yeah.
But there were some, the stage 5-6, were much more likely to refuse. You know, I just won't. I don't care if this is a scientific experiment. It's not worth the name of science. And so they quit. But here again, so that's another reason to, as many ways as we can, to help people keep moving. And it really does seem to be experiences, speakers, books. Encourage your youngsters and neighbors and whoever to read some books. And we could probably name a bunch of books that have helped us get a wider view of reality. Any others? Yes.
That came primarily to talk about whether they were conscious objectors or not. It's really interesting because if you're, when you're 18, I was really stunned by, I don't mean this to sound pejorative, how much 18-year-olds don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think out of the 200 that I talked to, more than one or two even knew who Thoreau was, or had read S.M. Civil Disobedience. They never heard of Gandhi. I could hardly believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a stage or age where you're asking people to make a tremendous kind of decision, and they don't.
Right. Right. And our emphasis, I'm a humanitarian and encourage, I love literature and I encourage people to read because that is one way that they find out, you know, if you know Thoreau and others through literature. But the 18-year-olds that you met didn't. Yeah, and education needs help. And some of the books, again, James Rest, one of my professors, says that if democracy is to continue, what we need to do is help people get to stage 5 and 6. They had done an experiment, a study. They'd gone from door to door and had several of the articles from the Bill of Rights and asked people whether these should be made into law, including freedom of speech. A lot of people said, of course not, horrors. It would just be chaos. We can't let, you know, all these freedoms. And so a lot of people aren't even with the U.S. Constitution. They aren't even thinking like that. And so if we're going to maintain our democracy, we need to help people keep moving and be able to think in the ways that our Constitution has been written. I guess our time, I almost feel like still taking, can you think of some reasons that we could use, like with stage 3, 4 people, to help them so that they would be willing to have a nuclear freeze?
Not responded to three, because responded children might be 3 and 4. Just thinking of raising their own children. I had the opportunity to go to Cambodia and work for 1 month in a refugee camp. When I came home, my son, who was 10 at that time, had organized an aluminum collection in his grade school class to send money for a food drive to Cambodia. Even in the face of much ridicule from some of the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
So our own lives affect our children's lives.
Right. And our friends and our people, at stage 1 and 2, you might have to appeal to material loss. You know, you won't have your house, you won't have your TV, and you'll suffer and so forth. Stage 3 and 4, social fabric will disappear. What'll happen to society? Rules won't hold, there'll be chaos and so forth. So there are rules, and I guess that'll be another time. Thank you.